Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First on the list today is libevdev. Evdev stands for event device. So this is a library that handles event devices. What is an event device? Well, an event device is something that streams data based on events to the Linux kernel. So you attach it to your computer and something happens on that device. And when something happens on the device, it sends some kind of message to your computer. So a common example, simple example would be keyboard or mouse, could be a gamepad or a joystick. If anyone uses those anymore, I guess probably the joysticks are probably used for flight simulators, I would imagine. But maybe those are different because those might not have an x-axis. I'm not really sure. No, you would need an x-axis, wouldn't you? Because you sort of tilt the plane or something. Anyway, webcams could be an event device depending on what is being used for. There's a bunch of event devices or devices that are classified as event devices that could be picked up by evdev. And what evdev does is that it creates a virtual device within your file system by creating a folder, you know, a directory structure in /dev/input, I think, /event0, event1, event2, and so on. Let me check that path and make sure that, yeah, /dev/input/ and then event something, event 0, 1, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 2, 20, 21, and so on. And then it looks like there's a mice and a mouse 0, which I just now noticed. And I don't know that those are specific devices or whether those are symlinks to an existing. I guess I can find out, couldn't I? Let's do /dev/mice. It's a character special. Okay, so that's the same as that's the same as every other event. So yeah, I guess, or event device. So yeah, I guess that's correct. Okay, so anyway, your device, it's streaming data to your computer, and this is within the Linux kernel. This stuff is being handled. So when it does that, it's streaming everything as a struct. So a programmer can expect what, you know, can introspect, I guess, what is being sent to the computer in their C code just by looking at whatever struct it is, which I think is something like input_event or something really obvious like that. So that's what evdev does. If people need to, if a programmer needs to interface and receive signals from you, the user, evdev is one of the primary places to look. And that is why /dev/input exists at all. That's where that comes from. So the question is, what's the difference between udev and evdev? Are they doing the same thing? Seems kind of like they are. No, they're not. They definitely overlap. But udev handles connections and disconnections of devices across your entire, of all devices across your entire system. So UDEV picks up when something is attached or detached from your computer. Doesn't matter what kind of device it is. If your kernel detects it, then UDEV reports about it. Evdev, again, handles event devices. So there are other devices, like printers, probably not an event device. Evdev, as far as I know, evdev does not deal with printers, but udev certainly does. I mean, it needs to detect when a printer is attached to your computer. That's useful information for you. It's useful information for your print configuration, you know, setting when you add a printer and you want to add one that's a locally attached. Your computer sees that printer because udev saw it and assigned it a bunch of special designations. Now, event devices are also detected by UDEV. So whether the event device is attached or not attached is UDEV's domain. EVDEV, however, translates those events and messages from, you know, a generic message into something that your computer could process. Okay, next package is libfontenc, or libfontencoding. The name says it all. As long as you know what a font encoding is, I think we've kind of discussed it before, but really briefly, I'll just say that if you type a message in one character set and you send it to someone using a different character set, there could be a problem without some kind of layer of translation, or rather layer of detection. So, for instance, if I typed something out in English characters and then sent it to someone whose system is set to, by default, to use only Japanese characters, there would be a disconnect there. Like the computer would receive the message and then display it using the default character set, whatever happens to map to the same character positions, the way that the font is encoded. But with libfontenc, a computer can receive a message and detect which character set it ought to use in order to display that message. Next package is libg, that's libgee, and it does have something to do with libgobject, or libgobject, as I prefer to say. Or is it libgobject? No, it's just gobject, right? Anyway, libg has a bunch of utility functions for people programming with GTK, gobject, and so on. That means that you are probably designing GUI interfaces, not necessarily, but let's say it would be a very common scenario for you to be using GTK for GUI interfaces or graphical user interfaces, and you might use libg to make iterating over something in that interface quick and easy, because libg, according to the header file in user include g-0.8g.h, there's a function to help iterate over lists and sorted sets and things like that. So it's little functions mostly. I mean, I didn't look through the whole thing, but it seems to be little functions being defined for utility purposes, things that a programmer reasonably could do relatively easily, but it's already there in libg, so a programmer doesn't have to do it. It's already done. That's the convenience. Next package after that is the libglvnd package. That's the GL, as in OpenGL, or Vulkan, I guess, Vendor Neutral Dispatch Library. Again, the name says it well. The expansion of the name kind of says it all. It is a vendor neutral dispatch library. It is a library that can manage OpenGL API calls between multiple vendors. It lets you it's good for a system that's going to use multiple drivers from different vendors, which could all potentially be utilized by OpenGL, figuring out which is which, who gets what message. That's what GLVND can do. After that, we've got a bunch of several libraries that have things to do with character input, they're input libraries. So, for instance, libhangul, H-A-N-G-U-L, that's a Hangul keyboard input library. It's for Korean. I'm probably saying the word Hangul wrong. Vaguely related. I mean, not really related, but in the same line of thought, there is libinput. Libinput is a Wayland technology, I believe. At least that's where its documentation is, wayland.freedesktop.org. But it's a library to provide a full, I guess, again, kind of a convenience stack for a display server. And from the documentation, I'm gathering that could be Wayland or X. And probably, I would assume that's probably X within Wayland. So it just seems to be a pretty generic input stack for applications that use input. And many, many applications do. And according to the documentation, it has little things that you can it provides a couple of different features that I think most users would just expect to have, and ideally most developers would expect to just have. So for instance, scrolling, button debouncing, like if you're pressing a button several times, like just pick it up once. Click pad software settings, how your touchpad buttons behave. Gestures, middle button emulation, that's an important one. Palm detection on a touchpad, and so on. So there's a bunch of little features that you don't want to have to think about either as a user or a developer. You just want it to be there, and libinput is the way that it is just there. After that, there's the libkkc. That's the Japanese kana kanji input method library. This allows you to put a kana string to kana kanji mixed string, which I don't know what that means, but that's what it does according to the little blurb in the package set. We've kind of already explored a lot of this with the other input settings, so I don't feel the need to really explore that all that much further. I don't know how related or unrelated this is to any other input method, but that's what it does. So there's also a related package to that, definitely related, libkkc-data, which contains the language model data that libkkc uses when it's running. Obviously really important for a Japanese user, or rather a user who is using Japanese. And I think the more I see all of these little fine detail libraries, the more it kind of just, it's almost amazing that, no, it's not almost, it is amazing that we have open source. That Linux exists is absolutely amazing. It just is. I mean, the amount of just variable use cases, it's just staggering. And I realize, I guess, that those variables, you know, those problems requiring a solution, those are met by because you have like 1 or 2 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 people in some region who are capable of writing this kind of low-level software. They have the time to do it, they have the training, they have the dedication, whatever they have, they've got the resources to do that, and then they choose to redistribute it publicly as open source. It's phenomenal. This is the kind of thing where I really think you can't take it for granted. It's such a big deal that we have Linux and FreeBSD or just BSD in general, the open BSDs. We have these technologies, and Alumos, we've got even I'm blanking on the name of the kind of poetry, haiku. I mean, all of these, and you know what? FreeDOS, and what's the ReactOS? All of these open source operating systems are able to sort of feed off of one another's efforts and borrow from one another to whatever degree they can or are willing to do so. And it ends up with like this super robust open source operating system, and all that almost undersells it. It's more than just the operating system. It is the entire open source ecosystem, as it were, that just kind of exists, I think, in spite of everything. Because really, there's no reason for it to exist. Like, it doesn't have to exist, is what I mean. Like, this could easily be a world where open source tried and just never took off. Just gave it a good go and then failed because there's so much working against it. I mean, there's a lot of different people need a lot of different things from computers. There are a lot of big companies out there that don't want open source to succeed. And yet, here we are. So it's staggering is all I'm saying. And it's really, really just a privilege to be a user, to be a studier, to be someone involved in any way with open source. It is truly a privilege. It's not time for a coffee break, but I just feel so overwhelmed by emotion. I'm going to take a coffee break. You should take a coffee break too. We'll come back, finish up the show. Okay, we're back. I have coffee. Hopefully you've got coffee. And I've overcome my sheer awe of open source. Probably not really, but at least for the moment I have. And it's now time to talk about libmypaint. And this is a fun one. It really is. This is just so cool. So here's the story. There was GNU Image Manipulation Program, GIMP. For a very long time, for a good, I don't even know, in my life, it was about a good, I think, 10 years. It was kind of the only, it was the graphic, the bitmap graphic application for Linux. There was GIMP and there was Inkscape. Now, that's not a literal statement. There were other things that existed. There was, I don't know, Tux Paint or something, or MT Paint, and all these other applications that were fine. But GIMP was the one that was like, if you wanted to be serious, you just, that was what you were going to use. Now, and there were other things too. I mean, there's Darktable for serious photography stuff. Or I should say, for a very specific workflow for your photography. There was, what was it called, Lightzone. And there was always Krita as well, but it was kind of in a varying state, for me at least. It was in a varying state of being a suitable application for a specific use case, which is a weird way of saying that it was, frankly, Krita was a little bit more of one thing and not enough of the other. GIMP was that really great middle ground where it could do photography, it could do it could basically do like digital art. Maybe you wouldn't use it full on just for digital art, although maybe you would. But it was just a nice, robust kind of do everything kind of application. And then Krita started to really ramp up, and Krita became, I mean, frankly, it's a contender for the graphic application for Linux, and for other platforms as well. I mean, I think you can get it on a bunch of other things. So, I mean, it's a big deal now, Krita is, and you can do photography in it and your digital art, and it's kind of a do everything application now, which it didn't used to necessarily be. That's where Krita is now. GIMP, it doesn't change very quickly, but at one point, GIMP existed, Inkscape existed, those were the two big ones, and then MyPaint came out of like seemingly nowhere. And MyPaint was just digital art, and it was a pretty simple application. So people put off from all the different options and all the sort of highly sort of professionalism of Krita, like the interface, MyPaint was kind of an attractive prospect. It was really nice. It had a brush engine, meaning you could choose between a sable-haired brush or a felt marker or a graphite pencil or a ballpoint pen or a felt tip pen or an ink, like a fountain pen, or spray paint or a sponge effect or charcoal, all these different things. And then you could use your mouse or your digital drawing tablet to draw, and depending on what kind of pressure you applied, the material would react differently, like the actual material would, like if you were doing it in real life. So MyPaint had this simple interface and a pretty darn good brush engine. And somewhere along the line, I don't remember exactly why or what prompted this, but MyPaint took all of their code for the brush material emulation and broke it out into libmypaint. It's the brush engine library for MyPaint, also called brushlib, and other projects could therefore import that library and get all of that brush technology basically for free. And so GIMP did. GIMP just imported libmypaint. And suddenly it's got a dedicated brush now. So there's the standard brush for that GIMP uses. It's kind of off or on. I mean, it's got some settings for like for how how smooth your lines are and how jittery your lines are and things like that. But that's fine. It actually works quite well, especially with clever brush design. You can get a lot done with GIMP. But with, I mean, LibMyPaint, or with MyPaint brushes, which are made available through LibMyPaint, it's amazing what you can do. And that menu now, or that tool now, there is a MyPaint paintbrush. Click on that in the GIMP interface, and you're now drawing with all kinds of different materials, and you have lots of different adjustments that you can do for your settings, and it's just it's beautiful. I mean, I'm not an illustrator. I can't draw to save my life, but it's a really beautiful, I mean, it can do, it's one of those things that's so good that it can kind of make your kind of half-hearted attempts, or maybe your wholehearted attempts, but still failing attempts, into something beautiful. It's really, really nice. So that's LibMyPaint. It is in GIMP now. Go get it. Now you can do all of your digital art and your photography and the combination of those two things in one application in GIMP. Whether or not, I mean, like, does that make sense? Like, maybe you want to do it all in MyPaint, and maybe GIMP is more of a photography application for you. I don't know. But I think that graphically, if GIMP is going to be what GIMP is, which is kind of like this mega sort of compositing image that can put lots of different sources of imagery together, that's what that is, really. I mean, even, you know, Photoshop, for instance. I mean, even that, from its name, Photoshop, you'd think it would deal with photos. But I mean, a lot of people use Photoshop for like illustration, or even for layout and all kinds of things that they, like, quote unquote, shouldn't be doing in a photo editor. But that's what that's become. And whether Adobe recognizes it or not, or changes the name to reflect it or not, I mean, they can't change the name now. I mean, Photoshop is literally a verb. But I mean, that's what that is. GIMP is the same way. Except that they maybe wisely just call themselves an image manipulation program, meaning it's just an image. It's a digital image. If it's an image, whether it's from a digital camera or something that you've painted with your little janky GIMP paintbrush, or your really, really nice LibMyPaint paintbrush, you can put them all together. You can put text on there. You can do whatever you need to. Bang. You've got a beautiful image that you can export into several different formats. So, I mean, it's great. I love GIMP. I think it is a very robust kind of all-in-one, do-it-all application. And there's a time and a place for specialty applications, but GIMP is a really good one that doesn't do specialty. It lets you do a bunch of different things, and sometimes you need that in an application. You just need the place where it all finally comes together. Krita is the other one, though. I mean, admittedly, Krita is a really, really great application. At one point, I was seriously, seriously thinking, and I think I still think about it sometimes, of just switching to Krita. And for quite a while, I stopped opening GIMP. I want to say I may have even uninstalled GIMP to force myself to continue to use Krita. It might not have even come to that, though. But Krita is really, really nice now, and it's not just a painting application. So if you want Krita to be your all-in-one, you can more or less get there. The workflow is different than GIMP, though. If you're used to GIMP, and I am after 20 years of using it, or almost 20 years, I think I started with GIMP probably in earlier than I started with Linux. So, like, a long time ago. Blender and GIMP were two, and Audacity, of course, were applications that far, well, not far, but they definitely were precursors to my Linux experience. I had discovered open source and had basically started just swapping out my entire workflow for open source with open source applications. So I've been using GIMP a long time at this point. And if you're used to GIMP, Krita is a different workflow. But with GIMP getting the MyPaint brushes, LibMyPaint, frankly, I mean, I think there's a pretty good sort of argument, if you're having an argument, that maybe GIMP is everything you need now. It does the photo and the digital art. What more do you need? I mean, you might need more, and you might want to try Krita. I love them both, so I'm highly recommending both. But LibMyPaint has made GIMP just even better. I mean, really, truly an amazing addition. Okay, let's talk libPCI Access. The name says it all. Generic PCI Access Library. It's for X. That's what it does. Let's talk about libpinion. No, let's not talk about that. This is the Chinese pinyin input library. Again, I feel kind of like we've kind of talked about this. I mean, we haven't. This is libpinyin. We've talked about, I don't remember what it was, but the input methods that allow you to type different things on your keyboard to end up with different characters on your screen. So we haven't really talked about this, but libpinyin provides support for Chinese pinyin. Okay, what we can talk about is libpthread stubs. This is thread support, a thread support library, but they're just little stubs, meaning that another library, like libxcb, for instance, could rely on libpthread stubs to use pthreads as an option, and that way they become thread safe. That seems simple enough, I guess, but what the heck is a pthread? Well, a pthread or a POSIX thread is a an execution model for code, and it's not based on a language, right? It's a POSIX thread, so this is external to what you're programming. This is something that happens within, you know, in the operating system. And it's the thing that allows a process to, something that you're doing through code to control multiple different jobs. So, and that may be creating separate processes. But all of those processes work together toward the same goal. And that's a tricky thing to do, probably not only because, like, someone had to figure out how to do that, like to fork a job in or a process into several jobs. I keep saying process, and I'm very, very aware that process has a specific meaning on Unix, certainly. So I'm trying to avoid that, but I keep saying it. But yeah, someone had to figure out how to make threads, right? Like how to do parallel processing, essentially. But the other tricky component about a thread, about parallel processing, is that if one thing finishes before another thing, what do you do? Like, when do you get them back together? How do you join that information back together? And what if the thing that has not finished yet is, could it be that the thing that hasn't finished is required by the thing, by something else that hasn't finished? Like, then you're creating new bottlenecks, right? Well, I can't finish with this thread until this other thing happens. Or worse yet, this thing thinks it finished, but it actually didn't because it needed this other thing that also hasn't finished, or that has not finished yet. And so now we've got this thing that thinks it finished correctly, but actually is missing half of the data that it actually needs. That sort of thing. All of that is being managed by pthreads. Like, those problems shouldn't happen when you're using pthreads, and pthread stubs are components, little pieces of libpthread, so that you can incorporate that into your code. Okay, next there's a bunch of libraries, or like three libraries that have to do with video performance, I guess. So there's libva, which is video acceleration. Libva utils, which, as you can imagine, would be utility functions for libva. And then libvdpau, which stands for a thing that I completely know. It is the, no, I don't know what it is. Oh yeah, video decode, acceleration, and presentation for Unix, or something like that. So all of these have to do with graphics processor units. Libva was written originally by Intel for Intel GPUs, graphic processor units. And the library is open source, so it has been expanded. It actually has code in it now for AMD GPUs and for other vendors, probably. I don't know. But the point of libva is to provide programmers access to an API for accessing the graphic processing instruction sets within hardware, like embedded in a hardware device. Normally you'd need a driver for that, but because libva exists, that can interface that it's not your driver, but I mean it's your portal to whatever that device is offering through libva. And that's similar in a way to VDPAU. I mean, it isn't, but it is kind of. I mean, libvdpau, the video decode and presentation API for Unix, also provides hardware decoding of things like MPEG-1, MPEG-2, MPEG-4, H.264, DivX4, DivX5, VC1, and whatever else. On supported hardware, and again, it's just an API that programmers can call to gain quick and easy access to whatever device you have attached to your computer, whether it's an Intel card or an AMD, or I guess probably an Intel chip or an AMD card. I don't know if NVIDIA. I'm sort of frantically looking for support, and I don't see NVIDIA listed here. And there is Mesa open source drivers for AMD and NVIDIA. So to some degree, there's a little bit of NVIDIA support. So at least according to this Wikipedia article. But you have the advantage here is that a chipset may have code, you know, burned into it, instruction sets programmed into it, to process, to serve as a kind of a DSP, or like a, you know, well, a GPU, another little computer living inside your computer whose job it is exclusively to do these specific or these kinds of calculations, whether that's like intra-frame prediction or rescaling video or performing like a motion compensation, you know, to offset camera bounce and things like that. Like whatever it might be, that you might have a chip in your computer that specializes in doing that kind of that function. But if you don't have access to that chip, then obviously your CPU has to shoulder the burden of all those calculations. Libva, libvdpau, libvautils helps you use the hardware that you've got to offload processing from your central processing unit to something dedicated to graphics. It's as simple as that. And by simple, it's really complex. But it's, you know, other people have figured it out, so you and I don't have to think about it. So that's libva and libvdpau. And then second or third to last lib package is libwacom. This is great. Love libwacom. I guess there are other tablets out there on the market where you can put it in front of your computer, take a special little stylus, and draw on the tablet and control your cursor with that tablet. But you also get things like pressure sensitivity and things like that. That's the only one I can think of. But for an illustrator, or even for someone who does illustrations, like, I mean, I technically that makes you an illustrator, I guess. But I mean, there have been several times in the past where I just want to draw a little figure of some sort, like whether it's an icon, or not an icon, but like a symbol on a map, or a hand-drawn flow chart or something, you know, whatever it might be, I want to draw it. And trying to do that with your mouse is really, really difficult. But if you have a little tablet, a little pen, you can just do it like sort of normal. I mean, there is a learning curve here. You have to learn sort of to control a mouse or a pen rather with your hand while looking instead of at the pen and the quote unquote paper, you're looking at your screen. That's the paper. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. Although, I mean, these days, you know, Wacom has tablets. I mean, it's not cheap, but I mean, there are tablets, I've seen people use them, that are screens. And so you're just drawing on the screen. I guess it must be like, I don't know, a really high resolution screen, or maybe it's one that's safe to, you know, do your pressure, you know, pushing down harder on it or something. I don't know what the big deal is, but I mean, well, one of the big deals is that you can look at it, right? And actually, you know, so you're drawing and looking at what you're drawing. So that's the Wacom brand. It is a brand of tablets, of digital tablets, drawing tablets that they're out on the market, and they're the biggest one. I mean, I feel like they were sort of the first. I mean, I don't know if they were literally the first, but they were the first big one that you really heard about. It was Wacom tablets. Like I remember when they were kind of a new thing, it was a big deal. People, it was just Wacom tablets. I mean, to the extent almost that for a wee while, I think, and maybe even now, for all I know, it was just a Wacom tablet. Like any tablet that you hook up to your computer and draw with was a Wacom tablet. That's not true, but I mean, you know what I mean? Like the brand name almost became the device name. And now I think you do have other brands doing this kind of thing. I'm almost sure you do. I don't know how big of a deal they are. I don't know if people actually use them. I don't know if they're just cheap knockoffs. I really don't know. But Wacom is definitely sort of a major player in that space. And for as long as I can remember, for as long as I knew what Linux was, and as long as I can remember from that point, Wacom has just had Linux drivers. Maybe they didn't at some point, like way, way back when, before I even knew Linux existed, but I did know Wacom existed. At that point, I wouldn't, you know, I don't know the state of Linux drivers at that point. But from the moment I started using Linux back in 2006 and had access to like school digital tablets, like I don't remember there being a time when there was not a Linux driver. Now, it could also be that I wasn't good enough with Wacom way back then to even know the difference between, oh, this is rudimentary recognition, and oh, look at the fine this precision of the pressure, you know, sensitivity, and that's, I don't know, but for a very, very long time, they have had specific Linux drivers, and it is just such a pleasure. Like, people have commented at me sometimes, they'll be bemused that I'm using a Wacom tablet, because to them, it seems like a very complex thing to set up. And I guess on some operating systems it must be, I don't know. But on Linux, I mean, you grab the tablet, you attach it to your computer, and I think you're good to go. I don't remember recently installing, oh, but I'm on Slackware. I have libwacom. That's probably one reason why that would be so easy. Yeah, so maybe on some other systems like Fedora, maybe you have to do like a sudo dnf install libwacom or wacom dash driver or something. I don't know. But certainly on Slackware, you plug in your Wacom tablet and you're going. You're done. It's that easy. And I've emailed Wacom a long time ago. I emailed them and told them that I really, really, really appreciated the driver, you know, the Linux drivers. I was just like, this is phenomenal. And they wrote back and they were like, thanks. We'll tell the lady who writes the driver. I don't remember her name. We'll tell her that you appreciate it. And I was just like, yeah, that's cool. Please do. For all I know, it's the same person to this day. I don't know, but it's very cool. It's so nice. It is the very, for me at least, it's kind of just the very model of what you should get with all hardware. It's just, we're beyond the point of pretending like Linux is a niche operating system. And you could, yes, it by the numbers, by the whatever, yeah, sure, it's niche. But I mean, it's got staying power. You know, it's been around for a while. I think we're at the point where we have to give it legitimacy just based on sheer longevity. And that's ignoring the fact that it's on every Steam Deck and on every Chromebook and all this other stuff. So I think at this point, you get hardware, there should be a Linux driver. Simple as that. And Wacom has been doing that through libwacom for as long as I can remember. Next up, XCB. This is the X protocol C language binding. So libxcb is the library that provides an interface to X, you know, the X window system protocol. And this can replace xlib. This is the latest and greatest. And that's what X uses for doing, you know, for when you're, if you're programming for X, you're going to be talking to libxcb, not libx, or rather xlib. You're using xcb, or at least you could, but they highly encourage it. It seems like that seems to be like the expectation that you're using that. And that, I mean, I need to qualify that. if you are programming specifically directly for X, more than likely you're not. You're using GTK or Qt or something like that. Or what's the other one? WX widgets, which I don't recommend. You know, so probably you're not using libxcb directly yourself. I mean, unless you are, but I mean, for a lot of people, for the majority of people developing applications that are going to run on an X server or on a system using an X window system, then you're not going to be, there's no need to talk directly to X. Just use a framework. I mean, that's someone else has already done the interfacing to libxcb. So yes, what I said about using xcb over libx or whatever, but also you're probably sort of not. You're probably just using a framework. Okay, just two more libs to go here. So the penultimate one is libx, what is it? libxkb file. This is a library that can help parse the xkb settings of your system. You may recall that the xkb settings control everything about your environment, or rather your keyboard, your input environment. So for instance, if you have set your keyboard to English, but the Dvorak variant, you're doing that with technically x zorg.conf variables or values for xkb layout, xkb variant, I believe, and there are other xkb options that you could set. For instance, a long time ago, you would have set them in zorg.conf. I've already talked in previous episodes about how miserable that was. It was the worst experience ever. You don't want to do that anymore. And luckily, because of newer developments in X and the migration to Wayland anyway, we don't have to worry about that so much. But you can kind of see, like, I mean, it's still working. It's still at play. Like, it hasn't gone away. It's just that you're not typing it into an indecipherable zorg.conf file, but you can see kind of the infrastructure that is xkb by looking at /usr/share/x, that's a capital X, 1 /xkb. There's all the files that it uses, and there's a whole host of files here. There's compat, geometry, key codes, rules, symbols, types, and within each of those within each one of those directories, there are a bunch of files just defining what kinds of things xkb knows about and can set your system to use. Now, this all applies, as you might guess, only to X11, meaning that if you boot your computer to a text-only interface, this is not involved at all. This XKB stuff, this is a layer within the X window system, for better or for worse. And I say that because there are other systems, there are other libraries that can affect the input and the way that your keyboard reacts and so on outside of X, before X ever gets started, or on a system that X doesn't even get started on. But because we're in the X directory, as you can imagine, this is related directly to X window system. So this library, the lib xkb file, simply, that's a library that looks at those files, at all those xkb files, and collates and parses and interprets and, you know, uses the information from those files so that you, for instance, wouldn't have to. As a programmer, you don't have to parse them yourself. You just make a call to libxkb file. And here it is, the last lib in the X directory. It's not the last package in the X directory, but it is the last package starting with the letters lib. This is the libx shm shared memory fence library, or package rather. And this has a little bit something to do in a way with what I was talking about earlier with pthreads, not directly, but it's related somewhat. So there's a concept of a memory fence, which is a kind of a wall, an invisible wall, or a barrier, I guess, as the as the term suggests, that enforces the way that instructions are carried out. And if it's a single thread, then the marching order is very, very static. Like, one process precedes another, and that second one never happens until the first one is through the door, as it were. But for a multiple thread environment, where memory could be all over the place and lots of processes could be happening at any given time, that could lead to confusion. Like, some process might get done, it might, you know, try to finish before another one that it relies upon has finished, and so on. So a memory fence is a sort of a class of instructions that ensure that the marching order, as it were, stays consistent and remains within sort of the boundaries of what's required. So libx, shared memory fence, provides a primitive type to that is compatible with shared memory sync fences within the X server and the direct rendering client, whatever all of that means. But that's what it does, right? It's an interface to ensure that threads, that the data that's happening in multiple threads can be synchronized. And that's important, especially when you've got lots of different jobs sort of working together and ideally in several different threads to accomplish some kind of unified task. I haven't done enough low-level graphic programming by any means to really identify with what I've just sort of explained from an academic sort of vague understanding of libx shared memory fence, for instance. But I do know that with a lot of the toolkits that you'll use, or the frameworks out there that you'll use, if you're asking an application to update itself based on input or based on the result of a process, in some cases you'll get like flickering, or something will fail to update before another thing updates. You'll get sort of you'll be drawing objects on top of each other that were supposed to be under each other, and so on. And that's partly because of this kind of these threaded tasks that need to be done in a specific order and synchronized between the thing that is sending the information and the thing that is rendering the information for the user, and that sort of thing. And a lot of times there's just some kind of flag or function that you need to call to enforce a thing. I mean, sometimes those things are built in, but other times, yeah, you have to make that call. You have to bring that instruction that function in the library, and then the function in to ensure that things are being synchronized or ordered correctly or whatever. I'm kind of imagining that for libx shared memory fence personally. It could be, I mean, it's definitely a lot more complex than that, but that's kind of what I'm thinking of. That's what I'm equating it with from my limited personal experience with programming, raw graphics to a screen. So that's all of the lib files. As I've said, in the X directory, there might be more lib files, you know, somewhere else, but those are all the lib files in the X directory. We're done with them. There are a couple more L entries. There's list res, there's linder and luit, but we'll cover those in the next episode. I feel like doing all those libs, that feels right. It feels like it's an episode complete, so let's just call it done. We'll do the L's next time and start the M's. That's what we do here. We just keep going. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.